For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Yeah, so we're four chapters in now in the book of Genesis. Genesis is a book of origins, so we're learning a lot of kind of just core issues about who we are, where we came from. Last week, what we got into was the origin of evil. We talked about how Adam and Eve, the first humans, rebelled against God and sin, and then that sin spread throughout humanity, as we're going to see as the book of Genesis unfolds. Now, I realize just by uttering the word sin and evil, I know I've lost a few people already, because in all our culture, people don't like these words. People, they're not comfortable using the word sin or evil. I was online reading a debate between atheists about whether or not evil is real. And this is what one of the participants wrote. He said, "Unless I'm speaking figuratively, I don't even use the word evil. There are good things and bad things, which are simply relative to who those things benefit or harm. Everything you might call evil is simply from your perspective." So this idea that, you know, evil is in the eye of the beholder. Evil depends on what angle you look at a situation from. That actually is an increasingly popular view. I just think it's very hard to hold consistently, you know, just in reality. You guys remember hearing about the story, this is a couple weeks ago, there was a couple in a house in California that had 13 kids. You hear about this family? They basically tortured, starved, you know, chained their kids to the bed, just brutalized their kids for decades. It's one of the most horrific cases of abuse in American history. You know, and so what are we supposed to say? That what happened in that house was evil from the perspective of the kids? And that maybe, you know, if you look at it from a different angle, it's not? You know, isn't just basically obvious that something like this isn't just wrong in California? And it's not just wrong in the 21st century? It's always wrong everywhere? Would we be satisfied to call parents like that, you know, maladaptive? Or, you know, I don't know, something like that. No, we need stronger language than dysfunction and things like that. We need the language of sin and evil to accurately describe some of the wicked things that happen in this world. And that's what Genesis 3 and 4 is giving us. It's giving us that vocabulary. It's a very important part of this book. So yeah, last week was the origin of sin and evil. This week we're going to look at a specific striking example of evil, and it's when Cain murders his brother Abel. And I'll tell you, I've been looking at this passage all week. One thing that really strikes me about this is, one, it's brilliant. It really helps you understand the psychology, the thinking that drives people to do what they do. And I think that's probably the best contribution here, is by kind of climbing into this story. It's a window into our own hearts and into what drives us to do evil to each other. And so what we're going to do to understand this psychology is we're going to break this up into four sections and just kind of work our way through the story. Let's begin by thinking about how Cain and Abel relate to God. I want to start here because on its face, the obvious difference between these two men is one's a murderer and the other one isn't. That seems to be the difference. But if you go into the story, it's clear from God's perspective there's a deeper difference between these two individuals. And it has to do with the way they relate to God. At the core, that's the most important difference in this story. Starts out, it says, "Now the man had relations with his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain. And she said, 'I've gotten a man child with the help of the Lord.'" All right, this is the first birth in human history. And Cain literally means, "I got one." That's literally what it means. And so you can tell, like, nobody's seen a baby born before. She's like, what? Look, I just made a human. I remember when my first daughter was born, I was in the hospital room, and I thought, well, okay, I'll probably be emotional. Maybe I'll cry. But I didn't cry. I remember when Maggie was born, I was just astonished. I was just like, holy crap. It felt like science fiction. I'd never seen a live birth. I was like, oh, wow, a human being just came out of my wife. And it had to, I'm just thinking, it was that way for her. She was like, I can't believe this. I made a little man. So it goes on, it says, she gave birth to his brother Abel. And Abel was a keeper of the flocks, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. Now, let me be clear. We'll get into this more next week. One of God's big commands at the beginning of Genesis to Adam and Eve is be fruitful and multiply. Have relations, have kids. And there's a lot of that in Genesis. Adam and Eve lived a long time. And we know that they had many other sons and daughters. It says that, if you look in Genesis 5:4, Cain and Abel are important, and that's why we're talking about them, but they're two among many children that Adam and Eve had. Now, it says here, as Abel got older, he became a shepherd, a keeper of the flocks, but Cain became a farmer, a tiller of the ground. So those are the occupations that they pursued. It says, it came about in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord of the fruit of the ground. And Abel, on his part, also brought of the firstlings of his flock and the fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and for his offering, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. Okay, so right here is the problem. We've got God responding differently to these different men as they bring their offerings to him. And it really raises the question, you know, why the different reaction? And of course, We especially today in the society, we like a neat, clean line between two groups of people to distinguish them, like a line of scrimmage in football. You know, there's Republicans and Democrats, there's communists and capitalists. We like a nice, neat, clean line, and when we read this story, the thing we zero in on is one guy's sacrifice was an animal, and the other one brought produce from the ground, tomatoes or grain or something like that. And that's it. That's the difference between these two guys. But it's not that simple. It's not that simple for a couple reasons. First of all, let's see if I can get this thing to work. As the Bible unfolds, it's clear it's okay to approach God with produce, with grain. There's something called a grain offering. And it's okay, obviously, to approach him with an animal as well. But there's nothing that would make us go, it's just a simple matter of animal versus vegetable. The other thing that's true here, and you might miss it if you read this too quickly, is he mentions both men first as he talks about this. He says he had regard for Abel, not just his offering, but the man, Abel, and his offering. And for Cain and his offering. So it wasn't just what they brought, it was who they were. It wasn't just their external actions, there was something internal, something about these men, something different between them that led to God reacting in different ways. It wasn't just this kind or that kind of sacrifice. What God was really concerned about was their heart attitude. And as you go on and read through Genesis and read through the rest of the Bible, you will see that it's our heart attitude that God is most concerned with. That's what he's really looking at. You know, we, like I said, we have like a bright, clean dividing line between different groups. God's dividing line is different. Here's 1 Samuel. It says, God sees not as man sees, for man looks at outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. That's his line of scrimmage, where your heart's at. It says in Psalm 51:16, you don't desire a sacrifice or I would offer one. You don't want a burnt offering. The sacrifice you desire is a broken spirit, You won't reject a broken and repentant heart, O God. So this idea, does God want us, you know, back then, did he want them to do sacrifices? Absolutely. He commands it. It's all through the first five books of the Bible. But does he want people bringing those sacrifices as some kind of rote religious procedure while their heart's far from him? No way. What he really wants is a broken heart, somebody willing to move toward him and depend on him. You know, one of the cool things about reading the Old Testament is we get the inspired comments of New Testament authors to help us understand these stories. And if you read in Hebrews, it talks about Cain and Abel, and the author of Hebrews zeroes right in on Cain and Abel's heart attitude. Look what it says. It says, by faith, Abel offered to God a better sacrifice than Cain, through which he had obtained the testimony that he was righteous. So something was happening. These men were bringing something to God in order to have right standing with him. That's what it means to be righteous, to be right in God's eyes. Abel did that successfully. Why? According to this, it's because he had faith. It was this heart attitude of faith as he approached God. That was the crucial difference. Yeah, so because that's such a crucial piece, faith. There's a lot of different heart attitudes that we have, but the one that we have to approach God with is faith. Because of that, I want to think for a minute about why this is important. Why is faith so incredibly crucial when you talk about approaching God like Cain and Abel did? You guys know who this is? Anybody? Alex Honnold. That's right, Tim. Alex Honnold is a free climber, a solo climber. No rope, no gear. Nothing. These are his hands. His hands. There we go. This thing's kind of stubborn. Yeah. With those hands, and only those hands, he climbed a 3,000-foot-high rock face of El Capitan. That's a huge cliff in Yosemite National Park. It was one of the greatest athletic achievements ever. And here he is standing at the top of the cliff. You know, just think for a minute. Think about the trust he would have had to put, the faith he had to put in those hands. They were everything. Those hands had to get him up that cliff face. He had to utterly depend on those hands and nothing else to do it. And that picture of, you know, when I approach God in faith, I'm utterly putting myself on him. I'm throwing myself at his mercy. I'm depending on him to make me presentable. That's exactly the attitude that Abel had. Abel had faith. That's why God had regard for his sacrifice. And if you want God to have regard for you, if you want to be able to approach God and know that he'll accept you, you have to have that same heart attitude. We have to approach God on the basis of faith. This is a bedrock teaching, cover to cover in the Bible. Nobody will ever be accepted by God unless they approach him by faith. It's faith and not works. Nothing we do. People do a lot of different things, like come to meetings like this, or they put money in a plate, or they do acts of piety, they stay up all night in a prayer vigil. None of that is going to make our heart right with God. It's got to be a heart attitude of faith and nothing else. You know, this isn't just a New Testament concept. Look at the way David talks about his situation. If you know King David's background, he was very sinful. And he just says, have mercy on me, God, because of your unfailing love. Wash me clean from my guilt. Purify me from my sin. He's not bringing anything to God. He's completely throwing himself on God and saying, help me. Please extend your mercy to me. That's a picture of faith. In the New Testament, by grace you've been saved through faith. And just in case we get confused, that not of yourselves, it's the gift of God, not as a result of works that nobody should boast. Nobody here is ever going to, you know, climb the cliff face up to heaven and say, I deserve to be here. Our hands will never get us there. That's not how it's going to work. It's faith and faith alone. Now, what is it that we're supposed to specifically put our faith in? We've talked about this. Last week, we said a lot about how when Adam and Eve sinned, God insisted that they wear these bizarre coverings of animal skins. God actually slayed these animals and took their hides and covered Adam and Eve's shame and guilt with these skins. The death of an animal as a covering for their shame and guilt. We saw how God began to instruct people like Cain and Abel to offer sacrifices. The death of an animal. Its blood shed as a substitute for us. It's a covering for us so that God will overlook our sin. And all of these grisly pictures pointing to Jesus' ultimate death on the cross for us. When we talk about, you know, what does a human need to put their trust in? It's not just vaguely God. It's specifically faith in Him to provide a covering for our sin, to make us acceptable to Him through the death of His Son, which is foreshadowed by all these symbols all the way through the Old Testament. That's that core attitude. Faith in God's provision for sin. That's what Abel had, and that's what Cain was lacking. I'm going to skip that. I want to talk about these three things. You think about Cain. Think about what he did, because we still do this today. Did Cain believe in God? Yeah, he believed in God. Did Cain go through some kind of religious ritual to approach God? Yeah, he did. He even gave up some of his produce, some valuable produce. But did God accept him? No, he did not. Why? Because he did not have the right heart attitude. He did not have faith. Well, what do we see today? Is it possible for someone to roll in and roll out of a place like this every Sunday? And to maybe even pray and kind of go through the motions and pay lip service and do the Christian rituals and do all the stuff and yet not have a heart attitude of faith? Is that possible? Absolutely. Millions of people live this way all the time. That kind of religious, my terms, my works, my procedures, that approach to God is so common. And this whole story is an indictment against it. It's not enough. None of it will ever be enough. It's got to be just simple faith and trust in God. His covering is the only way. That's it. Now, one more thing about this. Why is this so offensive? This is really a hard word. A lot of people, you know, just feel like I've just swept everything they've ever done off the table and said it doesn't matter. And that really upsets people. Why is that? Well, let's go back to our line of scrimmage. You know, our line of scrimmage is very external. We like to say things like, he's a sinner, I'm a churchgoer. Or, she's a substance abuser, I work out and take care of myself. Or they break laws, I keep them. Or they watch this kind of TV, which sucks, and I watch this. Or, I mean, increasingly it's I shop here and they shop there. We do all kinds of crazy things to say I'm not on the left, I'm on the right. And another way to think about this is all those things that we do to give us the settled sense that all is well in the world with us and God. None of them are enough. None of them. You know, I look at, you know, just looking across the crowd here. One thing I like about teaching in our church is this is such a crazy mixture of people. We've got the PhDs and the high school grads. We've got people that have grown up in poverty, people that have enjoyed great wealth. We've got people that are moderately good compared to others. And then we've got some pretty seriously immoral sinners here. We've got a mixture of all kinds of folks, but the Bible teaches that every one of those people has to pass under the same arch, and that arch is the cross. We have to humbly admit all of us need this. I like how he says it in 1 Corinthians 1. Paul says, God chose things in the world things that the world considers foolish in order to shame those who think they are wise. And he chose things that are powerless to shame those who are powerful. God chose things despised by the world, things counted as nothing at all, and used them to bring to nothing what the world considers important. As a result, he says, no one can ever boast in the presence of God. That's right. It's mercy or nothing. That's it. It's faith and trust in God. That's the only provision that we have. All right. Well, hopefully I beat that into the ground solidly enough. Now, let's move on and think about how God relates to Cain. This is where we really get into the psychology of what happened. As I read about the life of Cain, man, I can relate to this guy. I could see myself doing similar things. It starts out, it says, you know, Cain hears that God doesn't accept his sacrifice. And it says he became very angry. And his countenance is kind of a Hebrew phrase for his mood. He became depressed. So he became hot with anger and his countenance fell. And God notices. God notices that Cain's feeling this way. You know, and with us, when we're with somebody who's really upset, this is just etiquette. This is just the way we treat each other today. We feel the obligation to validate their emotions. You know, I think a lot of us in this situation, we would be like, Cain, I'm sorry, it sounds like you had a really rough day. You know, that's kind of how we reflexively respond. But Cain doesn't, God didn't get that memo. God does not operate that way. Look what he says here. He says, why are you angry, Cain? Why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? And if you don't do well, sin's crouching at the door and its desire is for you, but you must master it. Now, how do you feel when you're super upset and people start asking you, why are you angry? I don't know if you're like me, man. That sends me through the roof. I want someone to validate how I feel, not to ask me a bunch of questions. But that's what God's doing here. He's really challenging Cain's anger. He's not just being, well, I guess you had a rough day. He wants to know why Cain is angry. A lot of us wouldn't feel really comfortable doing what we're about to read that God does. But this is how he approaches him. And I do think it's tough because when we're upset, there are times when we're upset with good reason. You know, people are asking, why are you angry? And we have good reason to be angry. You know, why are you sad? Well, my grandmother just died. That's why. Why are you frustrated? I ordered a blue sweater from Amazon and I got a red one in the mail. Why are you so upset? Well, I came home and my teenage daughters ate all the cold cereal in the house. That's a hypothetical example. There are times when our negative emotions are legitimate and they're well-founded. But that's not the case here. There are other times when those emotions aren't well-founded. Have you ever had the experience where you lost something? Maybe you lost a notebook. You're kind of stomping around the house. Where is it? Who moved my stuff? Why are people always moving my stuff? And then you find it exactly where you left it the day before. Another hypothetical situation. Isn't it true that sometimes we're angry because we're misinformed? That's a lot of times we're raging around because we don't even have the right information. Sometimes we're angry because we're proud and we don't like taking input. We don't want anybody to challenge what we're saying. Sometimes we're angry because we've had these titanic, unrealistic expectations that nobody could meet. And yeah, they're failing to meet those, but it's ridiculous that we would have that expectation in the first place. Sometimes when we're angry or when we're feeling negative emotions, like Cain's situation, it's not our environment. It's not how we're being treated. It's not out there. It's in here. There's something broken inside. That's what's causing us to be upset. I'm not saying that's the case always. But we've got to have a category for this. If you're filled with rage and negative emotions, one possible reason, is it's not your environment. It's something in you. And that's what God, by asking this question, why are you angry? By coming to people and asking them things like, why are you afraid? God will ask these questions to get people to really think hard about what's going on inside. Okay, so here's another thing he does with his emotions. Another way God responds. He indicates that Cain's anger is tied to his sin. Hey, maybe you're upset because you're in sin. How would that make you feel? You know, I'll just to be emphatically clear. I'm not saying every time we have a negative emotion, it's due to sin. There's such a thing as righteous anger. Sometimes our negative emotions are very well founded, but his aren't. Cain's are not. God warns him, sin is crouching at the door here. You're in trouble. There's something going on inside you, and it's dangerous, and it could bubble up and lead to actions that are destructive. This is a tsunami warning sign in New Zealand. In New Zealand, you drive, you see one of these, you don't just blissfully go on your way. This means that there's a wave out there rolling into shore, a deadly wave, a destructive wave, a wave that you have to come to terms with. And that's what God sees in Cain. That's why he's speaking to Cain. He's like, Cain, sin's crouching at the door. There's this tidal wave of rage rolling through you, and something bad's about to happen. And so the idea that we might have somebody come to us and challenge us because they see something, they're trying to rescue us from the disaster they see us headed toward, that's what we see God doing with Cain. He wants to steer him away before something disastrous happens. And the third thing that God does is he advises Cain to do well. And what he's trying to tell Cain, and this is true for any of us in a situation like this, is that there's a fork in the road. There's a decision to make here. Cain could, if he allowed himself, be swept up in his emotions and driven by rage to do something terrible. Or he could, like God says, do well. And God points out, listen, if you choose this course of action instead, it will actually address your negative emotions. You see what he's saying? A lot of us, when we feel overwhelmed by negative emotion, we feel compelled to act. You know, I was angry, so I punched him in the face. I mean, what else could I do? That's how a lot of us, you know, we just feel like when we're in the grip of a powerful emotion, we must do what it tells us to do. But God's like, not, it doesn't have to be that way. You actually, Cain, can do well. And if you do, your countenance, your outlook, your emotions will be lifted up. In other words, instead of feelings driving his actions, God is telling Cain, you can act in ways that change your feelings. Also not a real popular way to think in our culture. You know, years and years and years ago, this is a long time ago, I had a member of my extended family who was just a pain in the butt to be around. And I resented her. I avoided her every chance I could. I wanted nothing to do with her. But just through a series of events, she ran into some serious health problems, and I was the nearest family member around, so I would spend my weekends going up to her house and caring for her. Just, you know, helping her get groceries or mowing her lawn or just keeping the house clean and stuff like that. And I remember just how much I resented that at first, how much I resented her, how I would replay things in my mind that she had done in the past. But something crazy, and I don't know exactly when it started, but maybe a couple months, I noticed that my heart was starting to shift. I'd go talk to her every day. I'd take care of what she asked me to do. And there was something about going into that environment and pouring myself out to her and caring for her, even though I didn't want to, that started to bring some kind of tectonic change in my heart. And I remember realizing I'm changing in the way I view this woman. And it's because, I think it's because I'm just acting every week and acting in her best interests. Can you think of situations? Maybe you were exhausted. You didn't want to do something. Then you went and stepped out and cared for somebody. And you could just feel your countenance lifting. It's your choice to act that actually preceded the change in your negative emotions. This is something that God's trying to turn Cain onto. You know, ways we could do well, ways that we could act that would affect our outlook. We could learn to apply and act on what God says. You know, just getting into the Word, trying to figure out, well, what is this saying about the way I should live, and then trying to live that out. Going on a short-term missions trip, serving in Renegade, getting involved with people that have, you know, pressing needs, going into a situation where no one's going to ask you how you're doing, but your focus has to be completely on how they're doing. Or situations like developing healthy friendships. Just, you know, where I'm going to go into a relationship here looking for ways to enrich this person's life. This passage and other passages throughout the Bible teach that a key pathway to mental health and having victory over powerful negative emotions isn't changing your environment. It's doing well. That there's a lot of health and sanity in that. And that is the path that God is trying to steer Cain down. All right, how about you? You know, if you're here, some of us are really at a fork in the road. Maybe somebody's confronted you, got you know, your attention and pointed out a flaw that you have. And you may be sitting here even right now super angry about it. Well, what's your next move? That's the question for Cain. Is he going to kind of coddle and nurture those negative emotions and steep and stew and boil over with rage? Or is he going to do well? And we've got to make that same decision. I'll tell you this. If you tell God, I know I need correction. This sucks, but I'm glad you've called this to my attention. Help me choose your path here. He will. That's the path to finding your way out of negative emotions. All right. So what does Cain choose to do? Well, we know what he chose to do. First he goes and he tells Abel, his brother. This is a weird part of this story. It doesn't say what he told him. Maybe Cain said, hey, God just dissed my sacrifice. He may have said that. He may have said, hey, Abel, I know this awesome field that mom and dad never go to. Let's go check that out. I don't know what he said, but we know this. It came about when Cain and Abel were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and he killed him. He killed him. And I don't know. You know, you think about, this is obviously what Cain chose. What was this like? How did it go down? These are, you know, Abel had never heard of anything like this. Was Abel shocked? Did he cry out? Was there a long struggle and Cain finally killed him? This, you know, did Cain pounce on him and catch him off guard? I don't know. But just think about, this is a human killing another human being. This is a horrible thing. Why did he do it? This is another thing we really don't know. We've got a little more insight into this, though. We don't have all the answers. But in 1 John, we read, don't be like Cain, who belonged to the evil one and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his own actions, Cain's own actions were evil and his brother's were righteous. So according to this, one reason it happened, and it seems like a weird reason, is that Cain's actions were evil and Abel's were good. Does that seem like a weird reason to kill somebody? I was thinking about this and I don't think it's that weird at all. I mean, how do you feel when you're right next to somebody and they're doing something well that you do poorly? I remember when Sudoku puzzles first came out. I'm sitting trying to figure out a basic Sudoku puzzle, and my wife's finished 3 Sudoku puzzles on the expert level. And I'm like, what? You know, just feel that sense of, I'm never going to do this again. This sucks. You suck. I hate this. This is the feeling you get when you see a bumper sticker like, my child is an honor student. Your reflexive response is, my kid beat up your honor student. Or, my kid got your honor student pregnant. I mean, you can boil over into kind of an insane rage, right? This is over the top. But that kind of just, there's this crazy jealousy, this just anger. You know, Cain's doing something wrong, and right next to him, Abel sticks the landing, and it's galling, and it upsets Cain. And it was a big reason why he killed his brother. So that's his choice. How does God respond to all this? Well, it says the Lord said to Cain, where's Abel? Where is Abel? Now, does God really wonder where Abel is? No, he doesn't wonder where Abel is. He's giving Cain a chance to look into his heart. And not just that. We saw this with Adam and Eve. By pausing and just saying, what's happened here? He's giving him a chance to confess and come clean. It's really a redemptive act of love here that God moves toward Cain with. Well, here's Cain's response. And this is just ice cold, remorseless. Where's Abel? I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? Man, you know, God said that if you're not careful, sin is crouching at the door and it's going to devour you. And it has. I mean, sin at this point has totally taken Cain over. These words are riddled with disdain and sarcasm for God. Well, God said, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground. Now you're cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you cultivate the ground, it will no longer yield its strength to you, and you'll be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth. All right, so this is God's response. You know, we saw back in chapter 3, God cursed the ground after Adam and Eve sinned so that it would take a lot of toil to bring produce from it. This is a little bit different. This says that they're cursed. Cain is cursed from the ground. In other words, he's a farmer, and he's not allowed to farm anymore. He can try to farm, but the ground isn't going to yield anything for him. He's done being a settled farmer for the rest of his life, and he's being banished here to wander instead. So that was his sentence, and he did not like it. Cain said to the Lord, my punishment is too great to bear. Behold, you've driven me this day from the face of the ground, and from your face I'll be hidden, and I'll be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me is going to kill me. Now, he's talking about the other descendants of Adam, which there were numerous other people over the course of his life. He's worried they're going to take him out for killing Abel. And, you know, there's a lot of things missing here. First of all, God did not cruise in and destroy Cain for killing his brother. You know, one appropriate response would be, thanks for letting me live. But he gives no thanks for his life being spared whatsoever. You know, another appropriate response would maybe now for the first time, maybe to break down in tears and be like, I killed my brother. I can't believe I took his life. But there's absolutely no remorse. None whatsoever. And this is a reminder. Does Cain feel bad about what he did? Does he feel bad about the outcome? Absolutely. He feels terrible about it. But his bad feeling is not owning his sin. And a lot of times we feel like just the fact that we're in misery over what we've done, that's enough. It's not enough. What God's looking for is an acknowledgement. I did do something wrong, and contrition. And then turning to him in faith and trusting him to forgive us. That's not what we see here. What we see here is Cain continuing to strike out away from God. Well, despite all this, this blows my mind. Despite the lack of remorse, despite how he's completely focused on his own situation, God's still gracious. The Lord said to him, therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance will be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord appointed a sign for Cain so that no one finding him would slay him. Now, nobody knows what this sign is. And it was like a red jersey, like a practice quarterback wears. I don't know what, but God did something to let people know you can't touch Cain. What a gracious response. He actually extends mercy by being willing to protect Cain. But nothing's going to reach Cain at this point. It says that Cain went out from the Lord's presence, and he lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. You know, this is a pretty grim ending. This is the crown prince of humanity striking out to be away from God. And I know that we've said a lot about Cain's perspective. I wonder how God felt as this happened. I think his heart was breaking as he watched Cain walk away. And this really is a fitting picture. This is what the Bible says is the state of humanity. All of us have strayed like sheep. All of us have gone our own way. All of us have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. This is the state that humanity's in. And that's the path that Cain chooses. All right. As grim as all that is, though, I think we can end on a note of hope. I don't know if you noticed, but there was a pattern as we went through this in God's dealings with Cain. You know, Cain was angry and downcast, you know, really, really upset. And God's like, no, there's a way out. You don't have to be controlled by these negative emotions. Cain was, you know, a murderer. He killed his brother, but God gave him an opportunity to confess his sin. Cain complained about his punishment with no remorse, and yet God still graciously offered to protect him. All through this account, you see this steady emphasis on Cain increasingly getting hardened, just determining to shut down and keep God out. And all through this account, you see God continue to pursue him. And those two themes, we get hardened as we say no to God, and yet God will keep pursuing us to the end. Those are all the way through the scripture as well. It really is true. When you say no to God, you harden your heart. I had a buddy who was part of a brand new startup, a tech startup here in Columbus. And he had felt some convictions about following God, like God wanted him to really step up and serve in tangible ways. But this company was taking off. He wasn't sure he could do both. And so the way he resolved his tension is he came to me and he said, I'm going to work my butt off for 5 years. And I'm going to make a pile of cash. I'm going to make enough that I can go into semi-retirement. And then from that day forward, I'm going to give the lion's share of my time to serving God. But for the next 5 years, it's all about this startup. And I just asked him, I said, how do you know that after 5 years of prioritizing work over everything else, you're going to be the same person that you are today? You know, saying no to God is a transforming experience, and it transformed him. It didn't take 5 years. Within 2-3 years, he didn't really have that much interest in the things of God anymore. I was talking to a kid in high school. And he told me, yeah, I believe in Jesus. I really do. And I really think I need Christianity. I want to follow God, but not now. I got some stuff I want to do. When I'm in college, I'm going to come back to this. But right now, no. And of course, he's in college and he's not into God. Because resisting God over time, it creates these layers of callus, just like with our hands. It builds up a resistance to the voice of God. It's little by little and bit by bit, but over time, we're changed into someone who has a very difficult time hearing the voice of God. So yeah, I think one lesson from this story is if you say no to God now, don't count on saying yes to him later. It can happen, but that's not usually how it goes. Another thing to keep in mind is all these verses where he says, today, if you hear his voice, don't harden your hearts. Now is the time, while we can still hear and feel God's conviction, to respond to what he's urging us to do. Of course, even when we've persistently said no to God, it's always possible to turn back because he never stops pursuing us. Some of you have probably heard of John Newton. He's a slave trader from the 1700s. He did a lot of terrible things as a slave ship captain, stuff that wouldn't even be worth repeating, stuff that haunted him his whole life. And he eventually went on to oppose the slave trade. and help make it illegal in England. But while he was wrestling with his faith, he reflected back and he said, I'm glad John 3:16 didn't say, God so loved John Newton that if John Newton believes, he won't perish but have eternal life. If the Bible said that, I'd assume some other John Newton was intended. He's like, no way could this offer of grace apply to me. I'm too far gone. I'm too hardened. But if you know this story, he not only received God's grace, he wrote Amazing Grace, that hymn, and he went on to be a powerful teacher for the rest of his life. And so there's, yeah, this idea that there's never a way to turn back, there's always, right now, a way to turn back to God. So the other thing I'd say too, you know, what happened, people always ask, so what happened to Cain? We don't know. Did he turn back to God? Maybe. Judging from what happened to his descendants, probably not. Probably not. In the end, though, it wasn't God who left Cain. I think you'll agree it was Cain that left God. If somebody winds up spending an eternity apart from God, that'll be an outcome they choose. It's not something that God chooses for us. So, yeah. Yeah, Father, we thank you, too, that we saw you in the Garden of Gethsemane choose against your feelings. And you went to the cross for us. You know, following you doesn't always make us feel good. And that's not why we follow you. But you said you did it for the joy set before you. And you promised that as we step out in service and give our lives away, that we'll have a deep-seated sense of fulfillment, Lord. I pray that you would give us the courage to reach out and pursue that. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.